Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. From many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's July the 23rd, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. We'll take the week's main development first. On Friday, July the 17th, I received notice in the mail that my book publishers, all three of them at once, are canceling their contracts with me to publish my fiction and make it available for sale through their online distribution networks. It is, of course, impossible to obtain any details on how this decision was reached, or by whom. This whole business will almost certainly remain forever the responsibility of the usual amorphous, glutinous American they. And we all know who they are, don't we? My books are being pulled off the market, all of them, not just the politically and racially oriented ones. A total of 15 novels are affected, of which only 5, the Northwest Novel Quintet, are overtly racial or political in nature. It's not just those specific books that these people are attempting to silence. It's me. If these publishers keep their word given to me in their letters and stick to the provisions of the contracts, which may not turn out to be the case in practice, then admirers of my Northwest novels have until August the 14th to order any last copies of any of my books they want online. After that, no one will be able to purchase a copy of any Covington novel, Northwest or otherwise, unless you can find one floating around in a used bookstore somewhere. This is the American way of suppressing dissent while maintaining the fiction that the old Constitution is still in force. De facto, not de jure. Banning and suppressing books is a blast from the past, the old ADL trick. While it will not technically be outright illegal to own or read a Covington novel, as it is in Canada, one simply will not be able to find a copy to read. Or so the theory goes, at any rate. No reason was given for this decision in the formal letters notifying me of the ban. None is needed. We all know what I've done wrong. I have spoken aloud of the death of the king, an offense which in Henry VIII's time would have gotten me boiled in oil, but which today is punished with more subtlety and in some ways much greater cruelty. Americans are weak, high-strung, neurotic, and brittle people. Cyber-shaming, silencing, rejection, Twitter-screamed abuse, and economic discipline, as the left calls it, can, in fact, destroy Americans mentally and physically. Now, I sometimes joke about that ridiculous wog in Canada who's been trying to achieve his stated intention from back in 1998 of driving me to suicide by saying bad things about me on the internet, but it's not really funny. Now, that very thing has happened with unstable people before. Often tragically young white kids who have never learned that the majority of other human beings are suppurating pustules whose opinions on anything are worthless and who are to be ignored. Fortunately, I'm one of the older models. A few of us are still around, although it's increasingly hard to get parts. I doubt if a visit from our friends in the silk suits to these publishing houses was even necessary. Somebody in a carpeted and air-conditioned office picked up the phone and called somebody else in a carpeted and air-conditioned office, and my books disappeared from public view, or will do, after August 14th, again with the caveat that they keep their word. The possibility that I might have a legal or moral right to be different and to think different thoughts other than those approved by the One and the Democratic Party. The fact that this action on their part was unconstitutional, illegal, and utterly vicious and immoral never entered into these people's minds. Nor would I have expected it to, ruled by who and what we are ruled by in this day and age. Although the details of who picked up the phone and called whom are obscure and will probably never be revealed, there's no mystery here. We all know who's behind this, at least in a general way. Frankly, I'm astounded and maybe even a little grateful that they left me alone for 15 years. The highest compliment that one man can pay to another is to attempt to silence him by force. To have one's books banned and suppressed by a tyrant is perversely one of the greatest honors that any author can receive, and I feel honored. I'm in good company now. Giordano Bruno, Michael Servetus, Copernicus, Galileo, James Joyce, Solzhenitsyn, 100 others. I am not as good as any of those giants. I know it, and I'm not claiming that. But I find myself sitting at the same table with them, and I'm humbled and awed. No kidding, guys. In a perverse kind of way, this is a victory. I've forced the United States of America into a humiliating expedient, one seldom availed of in the past because it was not thought necessary. But in my case, apparently it is. Basically, I've beaten America. They have now admitted that their laws, their society, their system is too weak, too confused, too incompetent, too quavering with senility to withstand my words and my ideas. And they're right, of course, to be afraid of me. America isn't strong enough to allow Harold Covington's novels to be read. My words and my ideas are more powerful than America. Well, Obama's America, anyway. I'm not going to go off into a long oration about freedom of speech and all that rot. The mere fact that my books are being suppressed at all without any appeal or recourse or discussion tells us that there are no freedom of speech issues here because there is no longer any freedom of speech in this country. People, I'm dead serious. November the 20th, 2014. Burn that date into your memory. Since then, we have been living in a third world dictatorship which is ruled by the stroke of Barack Hussein Obama's pen, in which the people's elected representatives sit there like potted plants, cowering in their $3,000 suits, and in which white males are third-class citizens. Okay, enough for now. It won't work, of course. They don't get to do this. Needless to say, steps will be taken to make sure that anyone who wants to read a Northwest novel, either electronically or from a printed volume held in the hand, will be able to do so. I have posted on the Thought Crime blog a link to the official discussion thread on this topic, which is in turn on the Homeland blog. Guys, let me remind you again, August the 14th is the deadline. Make sure you order online any last copies of any of my works that you want to get hold of before then. I will publish and circulate a list of links to all my books on Thought Crime and elsewhere in a few days. Now, I'm not going to let this episode of Radio Free Northwest degenerate into one long whine about my own problems, so on with the show. I was doing some transferring of files from computer to computer this weekend, and I took the opportunity to go over some of the weird mess I've accumulated on my hard drive. People are constantly sending me stuff, especially music tracks that they hope I'll play on the show, but sometimes I get odd spoken audio files as well, including this one, and more often than not, they fail to label the file or otherwise let me know who it is, and so I haven't got a clue. At first, I thought this was a rather strange woman speaking, but then I realized that he's using one of these voice modulation functions that you have on WavePad and Audacity that will distort your voice. And that seems to ring a faint bell. I'm not sure, but I think this guy may be Canadian, in which case we can understand why he's disguising his voice. Anyway, that's why he sounds like Alvin or one of the chipmunks. And let me guess, almost none of you out there even get that last reference I made, right? Never mind.
Next question from Bob in Ohio. Dear Rabbi Cohen, what are the Jewish plans for America? Well, my silly boy listener, we Jews have conspired, and yes, we do in fact conspire against Gentiles all the time on a global scale. Maybe not little David Bernstein from down the street, who's only a quarter Jew-ish anyways, meaning he's three-quarters goy, doesn't have a nose like me, and is only a useful idiot in that he will serve our agenda blindly just as all other Americans have over the last several decades, fighting our wars, doing our bidding, and actively becoming the pariah, in fact, the enemy of the world by doing so. Now, in that time-honored Jewish tradition of stabbing our Gentile hosts in the back, all the other stupid little goy in the world will gladly, without shedding a tear, come and hammer that final nail into the American coffin now that we have almost squeezed all of the life out of her and used her for all that she's worth. So thank you, America, and to all you brave Americans who died for us. And we're going to show you just how much we appreciate it very soon here. And no, we don't care how many stupid goy have to die on the other side of this battle. Because the more blood it's shed, the more profit we make, and the closer we get to having this world of our own to do to you and your descendants as we please. Pretty soon, there will be no resistance. There will be no one left to fight in your interest. And as a matter of fact, that leads me to my next question here from Jenny in D.C. Why, Rabbi Cohen, I must ask, do you speak so much truth against your fellow tribes? Well, little Jenny, let me put it to you like this. I can speak the truth all day and night, and the little white men dancing, coming around as messengers, telling you everything that's unfolding, exposing our crimes both past and present. And I, myself, as a Jew, can let you know our plans for the future. But it doesn't matter. The stupid, stupid goy are hooked emotionally to an extent that they will not even consider these facts, let alone accept them or act upon them once they come to discover this anti-Semitic truth. So that's why you can have a Jew like me, who's laughing right in your stupid goy faces. Because you're not going to do anything about it. You're not even going to accept these things, no matter how clear and obvious it can be. So I can laugh at you, right in your silly goy faces. And I can let you know exactly what we're doing, the crimes of the past, and the plans for your future. And you're still not going to do anything about it. In fact, I challenge you, Jenny. Go ahead and speak the truth. Line up your facts, one anti-Semitic fact after the other, and spell it out in plain English to every stupid goy you know. And I bet you, with my last shekel, that those stupid goy will not only turn their noses up, look at you in disgust, as if you were the hateful one who was wrong for daring to even speak about our crimes against you, but these stupid goy will continue to do our bidding, in any way and in everything that we ask and demand of them. You stupid, stupid goyim will never ever get it, no matter how obvious we make it, no matter how many crimes we confess to, and no matter what we tell you we're going to do to you. You will still sit there like the stupid goy that you are and accept everything that we do. And better yet, we will get you to do our bidding and then laugh in your stupid goy face. So thanks again, you silly goyim. I'll be back to laugh with you, at you, again next time.
Well, I haven't torn into the faggots recently, so here's another one of those songs that somebody sent me where, unfortunately, I don't know the name of the country group in question, which is probably a good thing, because if they were caught singing this song, whatever careers they might have would be over.
I turned on the television just to watch the evening news. What I saw made me want to crawl right through that tube. They were talking about a wedding, but they only showed two men. So I fired off an email with an invite just for them. Come on down to the farm, come on out to the barn. You won't see two roosters walking arm in arm. They couldn't make a chicken, they don't have an egg to hatch. When God said, love your brother, I don't think he meant like that. Now in that little email, I commenced to tell them how two mares can't make a stallion, and two bulls can't make a cow. Well, that takes a male and female for the species to go on. There'll be no reproduction if the plumbing is all wrong. come on down to the farm. Come on out to the barn. You won't see two roosters walking arm in arm. They couldn't make a chicken. They don't have an egg to hatch. When God said, love your brother, I don't think he meant like that. Now we used to teach our children all about the birds and bees. Now the world is telling them, do anything you please. We need to get back to the Bible, back to the gospel truth. Cause a million happy ganders never gonna make a single goose. So come on down to the farm, come on out to the barn. You won't see two roosters walking arm in arm. They couldn't make a chicken, they don't have an egg to hatch. When God said, love your brother, I don't think he meant like that. When God said, love your brother, I don't think he meant like that. It ain't normal. I don't care what they say. It just ain't normal.
As I explained last week, I am utterly determined that the life, work, and brutal murder of Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele shall never be forgotten. This is the second part of an interview that Steele did with the American Free Press from the Bonner County Jail a few weeks after the ghastly farce of his trial.
I've said it all along. I've always been paranoid, but I have proof of it now, and I have one of the world's foremost leading experts, the guy who actually wrote the book, a doctor employed by the U.S. government in the Los Alamos facility, who almost says so. And I have another guy who says that and more. Now, we had a hearing 4 or 5 days prior to the trial about these experts, and you do that when there's a challenge by one side as to qualifications to testify. And the other side, the government, of course, predictably made just such a challenge to both of these experts that, in my experience, should easily qualify to testify at trial. And the judge ruled that neither would be allowed to testify. Astounding result. At the last minute, almost literally hours before trial is scheduled to begin, no continuances granted. There's no way to delay this now. And he says, my experts can't testify. What he said was that the guy with the police departments was unreliable, said he didn't have a complete enough background. Problem is that that guy was willing to express an opinion that was right on point. Yes, they're fabricated. It's not even his voice. Said he's unreliable. Wouldn't even let him testify. I maintain that that was incorrect. What should have been done is he should have been allowed to testify, and the jury cautioned to give his testimony the weight that they felt it deserved. That's how you handle something like that. He was eminently qualified to testify. Now comes Dr. Papsen, the world's foremost leading authority on forensic audiology, the guy who literally wrote the book, a doctorate, and an employee of the U.S. government, who says everything up to the most inflammatory things that my first expert said. The judge said Dr. Papsen couldn't testify either. You know why? Because his testimony was irrelevant, that nobody had put into issue an allegation that the tapes were false. Excuse me? I had been talking about nothing but that up to that point. That hearing put it into issue. Listen, when I stood up at my arraignment a week after being arrested and I said not guilty, that controverted all the allegations of the government, including the tapes. When I said not guilty, that alone called their authenticity into question. But the judge said, no, they're irrelevant. Won't let you let him testify. And that was it for my experts. I wouldn't be allowed to put on any kind of evidence that the tapes were false, even though I had done more than I needed to do that. Dr. Papsen took his wife, went on vacation, a long-standing prepaid vacation of a lifetime, to Tahiti. He had been willing to stay behind if he was going to testify, and I'll be honest with you, I would have somehow found a way to compensate him so that he could then take her a couple of weeks later. There's no question about that, but the judge said he couldn't testify, so Dr. Papsen went on vacation, confident that he wasn't prejudicing my case. The first or second or third day of trial, my attorney again complained to the judge about not being able to put on this evidence, and the judge reversed himself, amazingly enough, and said, okay, Dr. Papsen can testify. And we all went hurrah, and then we remembered that Dr. Papsen is off in Tahiti with his wife. So my people scurried, and they got hold of Dr. Papsen, and they got him to agree to testify over the internet by video phone, you know, something like Skype. My attorney approached the judge, and the judge said, okay, that's acceptable. The morning of the day that Dr. Papsen was to testify, the judge reversed himself again on the government's motion and said, no, he's not going to allow it by video. Papsen has to be here in person, and he has to be here the next morning at 8:30 sharp from halfway around the world. Obviously, we couldn't get the guy here the following morning at 8:30. Well, there's another thing to tell you about. It's almost impossible to get him here at 8:30 in the morning. Turns out it was impossible, but I'll tell you about that in a moment. There's something you need to understand about trial witnesses, especially expert witnesses, in order to really get what I'm about to tell you about what the judge did next. You have to understand that if a witness has not been served a subpoena, you don't have an issue on appeal about that witness not testifying, and you don't have a basis for asking the judge for a continuance or a delay in the trial. If you've got the guy under subpoena and he doesn't show up when he's supposed to, then you can go to the judge and say, Judge, I did everything I was supposed to do. He's just not obeying the subpoena. Issue a warrant for his arrest and threaten him with contempt of court. You know, it's your job to get him here now. I did what I was supposed to do. As a practical matter, there are a lot of witnesses who, if you give them a subpoena, will become hostile to you. And Dr. Papsen, being the prima donna that he is, and knowing that he had this prepaid vacation scheduled that he had already offered to forego if he was allowed to testify, he told us that if we put a subpoena on him so that he couldn't leave the country in the face of the judge having ruled that he couldn't testify, that if he ended up testifying, he would not be a good witness for me. You get that all the time from witnesses. Don't put a subpoena on me, you won't like what I'll say. And so as a trial lawyer, you need to make a choice. Do you put a subpoena on a guy and run the risk of alienating him, or do you play ball with him? I knew this was going on. In writing, I gave to my attorney the following. I said, lay a subpoena on Dr. Papsen so that we preserve the issue for appeal. Gave it to him in writing. He understood that, nodded and said, okay. He didn't do it. He decided on his own and without telling me not to put a subpoena on Papsen because I knew how important it was. He was my whole case. And as it turns out, he was my whole case. Remember I said that things can be too good to be true? Like those tapes that they alleged that I discussed the plot twice with this North Idahoan hitman? They're too good to be true because of their content. Well, unfortunately, my lawyer's too good to be true, too. And he's a very good lawyer, and that's the problem. He's a gunslinger. It's like when I went to school, I was good enough that I could get decent, I could get good grades, very good grades, without ever taking a book home. Now, that's high school. College wasn't much more difficult. And I even earned a master's degree from Cal Berkeley without really learning how to study. It wasn't until I went to law school and I was thrown up against 3.9 grade average students with 99th percentile LSATs that I finally had competition that forced me to study. And I learned how to study in law school for the first time. Well, public speaking and trial lawyering is kind of like that. If you have a natural talent for it, you never get pushed enough to really learn the craft. And unfortunately, in my opinion, Bob McAllister is cursed to have that degree of talent. He's always gotten by just winging it. That's why I call him a gunslinger. He just wanders into town and fires a couple of shots and his job is done. It don't work like that at this level of litigation. It requires greater preparation. And he didn't engage in that because he didn't know that it was really necessary. He thought he was going to ride into town, fire a couple of shots, prevail, and ride out a hero. He learned differently. So did I. Against my better judgment, I relied upon what I call speed lawyering and let him have his head. Against my better judgment, I didn't testify. Big mistake. I should have taken the stand and spent a day talking to the jury. But I have some issues with McAllister's representation, which go to the heart of why I lost. But the main issue is I didn't have Dr. George Papsen on the stand to testify, essentially, that those tapes were fabricated.
Is there a chance with the appeal that you can get him back?
Yes, there is. There is a chance on appeal I can get him back. If I can get a new trial, then we can call him. And I guarantee you he'll be on the stand then. And in fact, if we can get a new trial with a new judge, we'll get that other expert on the stand, the one who said, in his opinion, my voice had been morphed from somebody else's. That's how important George Papson was. And without his testimony that essentially and substantially challenged the validity of the tapes, all we had was my wife and my kids and my friends saying, geez, that doesn't sound like him. We don't think he'd ever say anything like that. And they took the stand and they said that, but it wasn't enough to persuade the jury. They just thought that my wife and my friends were protecting me. Of course, that raises an interesting question, doesn't it? My wife supposedly is the victim. Supposedly, I wanted to blow my wife up with a car bomb. And yet, she's standing by me right from day one. She is standing by me again today. I mean, I talk to her two or three times a day on the telephone. I love her to pieces. She loves me. She has never wavered in believing that those tapes were false. I told her the day I was arrested they were false. I knew they were, even though I'd never heard them, because I knew I hadn't participated in those conversations. I knew I hadn't said the things that were being attributed to me. And she knows me well enough after 25 years of marriage to know it was the truth. I'm a lucky man to have a woman like that, by the way. Yeah, not many guys do.
I think you are. I spent many hours with your wife on the phone going over this case. And
she's a sweetheart. You know,
she's great. She's so authentic. That's why I'm surprised that the jury...
We all thought that she's so authentic and believable that she'd probably carry the day all by herself with the jury. That was a large part of why I never testified. See, I was real close to the edge and getting angry with everybody at the time. And if they'd put me on the stand, I would have ended up fighting with the prosecutor, almost certainly. And that might have worked against me more than it would have helped me. In retrospect, it was a mistake. I had to take the chance. But at the time, I bowed to the pressure from lawyers and from my wife, who didn't want me to testify, to not be my own worst enemy, as they put it. I yielded to that against my better judgment.
What are the chances of you winning on appeal? Knowing what you know and what you've been talking about, how they obviously clearly manipulated this case.
I don't know. I don't know is the honest answer. It depends upon how deep the rot goes. We're making a motion for a new trial with the trial judge. I know that's going to be denied. There's no way that this guy is going to start ruling favorably for me now. Not after what he did before trial, not the way that he ruled on objections during the trial, because right down the line, he was a prosecuting judge. In fact, with a judge like that, you don't even need a prosecutor.
I want to ask you something about this judge. You were talking about how the judge first decided that the New York expert witness could not testify because he wasn't qualified enough. Then he said the doctor in Tahiti couldn't testify because there was no question as to the validity of the tapes. And then he ruled that, yes, he could testify, and he could testify by video conferencing. And then the government approached him, and then he said, no, I changed my mind. He has to be here at 8:30 in the morning the next day. Do these judges have that much leeway and discretion that they don't have to consult law, they don't have to consult precedents in these matters? They can just, it seems like he's just ruling like, gee, should I do this or do that? I don't know. How do I feel today? Well, you know what? I'll make the guy come in from Tahiti. Is it something like that, or am I missing something here?
No, you're not missing a thing. Feels like that to me, too. I'm not alleging that the judge is corrupt. I'm not alleging that the judge was gotten to. Trials like this happen this way with judges without any kind of bias-making pressure from anybody. Maybe that's what happened in my case, but it's awfully coincidental that in a heavily charged political case like this, that I would draw a judge like this. And I'm glad you mentioned that about Papson again, because I promised to follow up and explain something. Papson could have been brought back here on a commercial flight in the time we had from the time the judge changed his ruling until the time that Papson had to testify 2 days later in the morning. However, the judge said doing it by video would be good enough. So we relied upon that. We relied upon that. Remember, we didn't have Papson under subpoena. The following day, however, with less than 24 hours to go, the judge then reversed himself again and said Papson couldn't testify by video. He had to be here in person at 8:30. It now was impossible to get him here commercially. We actually checked into chartering a private jet. We had enough time to get him here 8:30 the following morning from Tahiti. We found a private jet that had enough time to get there to Tahiti, pick him up, and have him in Boise by 8:30 the next morning. We actually had that lined up. I'm not even going to tell you how much it would cost because it's a mind-blowing number. But we're talking about the rest of my life here. my wife, friends, got together and said, okay, let's do this. And then found out that suddenly the charter company, for some reason that was never disclosed to us, suddenly decided that they didn't want to fly the guy back for us.
They didn't want to make money.
You got to wonder what went on. Let me tell you how much it cost. $180,000 to charter the jet and bring the guy here. We were willing to pay that. Charter company changed his mind, said, sorry, we don't want to do it. The jet's no longer available to you. It now became impossible get him here at 8:30 the following morning, and that is why he did not testify at my trial. That is why we were unable to put on any evidence of the fact that these tapes had been falsified, even though we'd spent more than one full day a week or two earlier with these experts testifying extensively and showing waveforms as to why the tapes were falsified. We weren't able to put on any evidence of that for the jury, and that is the main reason why I lost this case.
Did the judge know that Apkin was going on vacation?
Yes, he had been told. You know, I'm not going to make the obvious connection. I'm not going to make an allegation like that out of anything more than just conjecture. I told you the facts. I've told you the truth. You draw your own conclusions. But there's a lot of things about this case that began with my arrest, which are really strange, things I couldn't make up. If you had told me about this case involving somebody else, I would have told you before I got hit with it that it couldn't happen.
Edgar J. Steele from the Bonner County Sheriff's Jail, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to our listeners. And I want you to know we're all thinking about you and we're all with you. I know that I am, and I know enough about this case to know that you are innocent.
You know, one of the things I've noticed about this is that I don't know of a single friend that I've lost because of this. In fact, I've gotten a lot of good new ones. That's
right.
A lot. And I appreciate having friends like you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
This is the Corries.
Every dungeon's dark and strange. The wretch's destiny. Fashion's time will not be mine. On yonder gallows to be. It was by a woman's treacherous hand that I was condemned to die. She stood up in a windy ledge and a blanket drew over me. Say rantingly, say wantonly, and say wantonly, baby. He played a tune and he danced around below the gallows tree.
Danced
Comrades. Tonight I'd like to talk about Arthur Kemp's book, March of the Titans. Now this is a worldwide white history, and the idea for this gigantic book came to Arthur Kemp in the mid-80s, but this book is frequently updated to reflect the most recent genetic data. Race is tracked in various ways, and one of them, of course, is forensic science. Then you have artistic depictions, if realistic. Then you have language and, of course, genetics, which is really the greatest aid in terms of understanding race. Now, you have three types of genetics. You have mitochondrial DNA, Y lineage, and autosomal. And of those three, really the autosomal is the most informative. Now, Kemp wants to know, why do some civilizations persist and thrive when others are an influence at one time in world history, but then never an influence again? Now, of course, many superficial answers are given, but Kemp really wanted a definitive answer, and his theory is that any society will reflect its demographics. So it really doesn't matter what culture, if any, is the more advanced. A society will always reflect the majority of the people that live within it. So civilizations don't fall so much as they are replaced. For example, you might ask yourself, why is Egypt not advanced today? Kemp points out in this book that writers of early history really liked to write about the Mideast, and particularly the farming that went on in Mesopotamia. But if you've ever seen any pictures of the Mesopotamian region, you can see that really it's very dry. So outside of a small area that they were able to irrigate from the Euphrates, really, it's not such a great place for farming, but he does say that Europe had farming by 8000 BC, and there were also Neolithic villages. He also talks about ironwork and other types of metal working that took place in Europe. He also talks about how there were various stone monuments, and it's not just Stonehenge, there are other monuments as well, that were around as early as 3000 BC. In southern Russia, as the ice sheets were retreating, particularly near the Black Sea, you got a lot of flooding. And at around that time, that was when you had the migrations of the various Indo-European groups. Of course, that would become very influential as far as culture and language within Europe. Now, in some areas, Indo-Europeans tended to blend with the old Europeans, and this happened primarily in southern Europe, whereas in northern and western Europe, they tended to mix with the Proto-Nordics. Now, in certain respects, he also comments that the Western Slavic populations are also very true to type as far as having a lot in common with the original Indo-Europeans. Now, he speaks of the Tocharins that went all the way to China, and also some whites from the Canary Islands that came to the Americas. He speaks of Incas and how they have various tales of red-headed whites that dwelled among them for a time and then left in a boat. The author really likes to focus on civilizations such as Egypt and Rome that became very successful or large, and then more and more other groups wanted in. Now, eventually, for example, the Romans passed a law that said that any Roman within the empire could become a senator, And eventually they gave universal citizenship within Rome. More and more, as the Roman population took on more and more non-whites, the Romans used Germanics for their defense. And this also happened to Constantinople once the empire broke apart and Constantinople was established. Now, Arthur Kemp talks about the first race war, which was the one against the Huns. This went from 372 AD to 454 AD. The fact that even though the Romans and the Germanics would sometimes dislike each other, the fact that they both found a mutual difficulty with the Huns. And eventually, the Huns became so aggressive that they were a problem not only for the Germanics, some of which ended up moving to the area that is now Romania because of the Huns, but also Rome was actually paying tribute to them. The Huns were centered in Budapest, in the area that is now called Hungary, and eventually the Huns were defeated by a group of primarily Germanic tribes, although there may have been some Alans included as well, and the Alans were more of a Scythian group who sometimes would side with the Huns and sometimes would side with the Germanics. The fact that the Huns were finally beaten at Nidau in Pannonia was, of course, and that's an area between Italy and Czechoslovakia. Of course, that's very significant because they were extremely aggressive and they would really have overrun all of Europe. Now, as a result of the Huns being defeated, both the Germans and the Slavs were able to move somewhat farther east. Also, another thing that happened is that the Icelandics started to have a new word for the Germanic tribes that would mean defender of the people. Now, as the Roman Empire went on, by 400 AD, the Romans were often pretending to be whiter than they really were, and of course they were using Germans to fight for them. By 410 AD, Rome itself became very weak, and really anyone could take it. So you have various Germanic tribes that started vying for it. However, there were some tribes, particularly the Ostrogoths under Theodoric, that were rather nostalgic to reestablish Rome, and they attempted to do so. And also you had the Emperor Justinian taking a lot of land back from the Vandals in North Africa, and he was greatly helped by a Romanized Slavic general. Now, as usual, these conquests always tended to be short-lived because they never seemed to plan beyond a generation. Now, one of the good things that eventually happened was that the Lombards did move down into Italy, and they would provide a new gene pool that would be important during the Renaissance. Now, eventually, the empire divided, and Constantinople became a desirable location that diverted many people that would have settled in Rome. In terms of the Eastern Roman Empire, you also had a lot of Slavic tribes that were fighting for territory, and you had often Romanized Slavs fighting traditional Slavs for what was left of the East Roman Empire. Eventually, you ended up also having the Crusades, and they were endorsed by various popes. For example, Pope Urban II and Pope Innocent III. Some of the Crusades were actually temporarily successful. For example, you had the city of Tripoli founded. You had the Principality of Antioch, but again, they really never thought beyond a generation. They never had any migration to those areas. They never converted the natives to Christianity either. So because the areas remained Muslim, ultimately the Crusades were never truly a success. except for the fact they tended to drive out the Moors. And so eventually they were driven out from the areas of Spain and Portugal. So that's really all I have time for right now. I'm going to be, of course, adding to this series. You have to understand this is a very long book, and it's really impossible to summarize in one session. So I hope you enjoyed this partial review, and I'll be back with more later on. So have a good evening, and hail victory, comrades.
Last week, Adam from Portland asked me on the air to play a whole episode of nothing but Irish rebel songs in order to wash out the taste of the orange music from the week before. I won't go quite that far, but I will play what is probably, well, I won't say the most beautiful Irish rebel song ever composed, because that would be a really, really hard call. This is definitely in the top five, though, right up there with The Foggy Dew and Rising in the Moon and so forth and so on. The song is called Four Green Fields, and this is Mecham and Clancy.
What did I have? Said the fine old woman. Say, I had four green fields, each one was a jewel, but strangers came and tried to take them from me. I had five. One of them's in bondage.
24th Greenfield will bloom once again, said she.
All right, what with all that's been going on, it looks like this week I'm going to have to conclude with a fairly lengthy housekeeping segment. And I'm sorry if you HAC addicts out there feel you're not quite getting your full ration of Harrel this week, but there's some things I have to go over. First off, I'm sorry I wasn't able to do a call-in show last week, but I have the usual excuse. Something came up that only I could deal with. In this case, I'm sorry to report that an old friend finally gave up the ghost. Specifically, my old comrade in arms, my primary computer, who began life in Texarkana, Texas in 1998 as a high school kid's science project. A few of you ancient mariners out there who were on my list back then, and there still are a few, may remember a series of emails I sent out entitled From the Computer in the Crack House. Well, that was the computer, and yes, it was indeed a crack house in Texarkana I was living in at the time. Don't ask. I know 17 computer years is roughly the equivalent of about 108 in human years, and the old girl's time had just come. Nothing you can do about it. Still, as pathetic as this sounds, yeah, it's a loss. Not a human loss, but almost like my dog died. Anyway, the death of the computer generated a lot of stuff I had to do by way of data recovery and also transferring my sound editing capacity elsewhere, so it would not have been available on the Friday to edit the call-in show footage, and hence no call-in show. And I'm making this on Tuesday morning, and right now it looks good for a call-in show on Thursday night, July 23rd, 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Although, I have to repeat that right now the call-in show is a bonus only. It is not a regularly scheduled feature, and there are no promises being made. That being said, I need to give you a heads up. Next Thursday is July the 30th, which is at the end of the month, and that means Northwest Observer production and mailing time. So I can pretty much tell you right now that there will not be a call-in show next week. Now, the reason that we don't publicize the Skype number on the blogs, okay, I'm going to level with you. They say honesty is the best policy. Okay, we'll see how that plays out. It's because we do not want every Tom, Dick, and Jamal calling in and talking shit on there, either screaming obscenities into the phone or babbling about stupid crap that happened back in the nutty 90s that nobody remembers and only six people in the whole world care about, or else talking about religion or strange conspiracy theories in spite of my repeated and numerous courteous hints to the contrary. Now, none of that would get out on the air, of course, since the audio is extensively edited beforehand, and I'd simply hang up on any goat dancers or niggers or general trolls who called in, but if the call-in number was too widely publicized, like, say, posted on ThoughtCrime, it's possible that we would simply be overwhelmed with useless nigger and junk calls, and we'd end up with only 20 minutes of usable audio as the final product. Editing and putting up one of these podcasts is complex and time-consuming, and we don't have enough airtime on these shows to waste it. Secondly, okay, this gets into a little delicate territory here. I do not like and normally will not allow myself to get involved in secret squirrel stuff on this show, specifically responding to anonymous people who may or may not be as advertised with cryptic messages. It smacks too much of trolling. It smacks too much of making Harrel jump through hoops and getting whatever bizarre thrill a cyberstalker gets out of eliciting any response at all. But a couple of things have come up which militate for my making an exception this week. To the comrade who did the mass mailing in Idaho using the leaflet, "You're very fortunate to live in North Idaho, and you use the Seattle box as your return address," first off, congratulations on your sense of dedication and initiative. Like I said last week, I really like to see our people displaying some get up and go. Also, kudos on the leaflet itself. It's pretty good, and I'm sending it out to a number of our people as an envelope stuffer. I have some copies on hand, because about 30 of the envelopes that you sent out came back to the Seattle box, and so you need to be aware that whatever list you're working off of, you've got some bad names and addresses on there. I have no idea who you are. If I did, I would have saved the returned envelopes for you and sent them to you so that you could see which addresses came back. Second secret squirrel communique to the comrade who is making the CDs of these shows for me and sending them to me anonymously. I deeply appreciate your efforts, and since you've been doing this for several years now and I still have no idea who you are, I think it's appropriate for me to at least mention you and let you know that I am, in fact, receiving your weekly mailings. I am sending the CDs out with introductory packets, and I'm grateful for your contribution to the Northwest Republic. Thirdly, to the comrade who recently sent me an anonymous letter addressed in what appears to be blue felt-tip pen or blue Sharpie. I don't know what to say. I'm overwhelmed and profoundly pleased. I'd like to respond to you, but before I can do that, obviously I have to know who you are. Contact me with a name and mailing address. It doesn't have to be your real one, a pseudonym and a mail drop are fine. Describe your letter and its contents to authenticate yourself, and I will be happy to talk with you. Do not send an email address or phone number. What we have to talk about, although entirely lawful, is simply no concern of the FBI or the NSA or all the various reptiles who are watching everybody's electronic communications in this country. Now, to all the comrades who, on hearing the news of the cancellation of my publishing contracts, are screaming at me via email, "You gotta sue, Harold! Sue, sue, sue! You ain't a man if you don't sue and provide us with endless hours of entertainment! You're a cowardy calf if and you don't sue! Stand up for yourself, Harold! Sue! Sue! Sue their asses!" You know, a variation on the people who are, in other ways, as valiant as a lion with my ass. Kind of a let's you and him fight kind of thing. But, in point of fact, if I had sufficient funds and time to do so, I probably would consider legal action of some kind, since there is, in fact, in this case, a constitutional principle at stake here, although, as I mentioned before, we no longer have a constitution since November the 20th, 2014. I'd love to be able to establish some kind of legal precedent basically stating that the denial of access to the media of communication is of itself a violation of the First Amendment. Oh boy, wouldn't that set the cat among the pigeons. Now, many years ago, that was officially the raison d'etre for public access cable channels, where back in 1987, the 7 viewers in Lizard Lake, North Carolina, who were awake and watching at 1 a.m. on Tuesday morning, could see Tom Metzger's Race and Reason. But, of course, that was before the internet rendered cable TV pretty much obsolete. The problem is that in this dictatorship, so-called justice is now inextricably linked to a cash register. The American Civil Liberties Union hasn't touched one of our cases in almost 40 years, not since Skokie, and the threat of their Jewish donors to withdraw financial support. Any lawyers we retain would have to be paid in cold, hard cash, and while justice is for sale in this country, it ain't for sale cheap, I can tell you that. So, all you guys out there who are hollering for me to bring a lawsuit against my former publishers, I will be glad to begin that process upon my receipt of your certified cashier's check in the amount of $20,000, with the understanding now that that's just for a start and I'll probably have to ask for more down the road. Somehow, I don't think I'm going to get any more of those emails. But, on the same topic, and seriously, folks, this thing that happened Friday is a game changer, possibly a serious one. I just don't know how bad yet. The saga is still unfolding, so I don't want to go off on a long pontification right now about how this, that, and the other thing, because I'm not yet certain what this, that, and the other thing are going to be like. Not yet. But I think I can predict this. It's going to be a really major drop-everything Harold. I'll be honest, when I completed Freedom Sons on Thanksgiving Day of 2012, I pretty much thought that I was done with writing, at least writing fiction, and that the next part of my life would involve other things. Well, it hadn't played out like that, and it looks like I'm going to be forced to go back to the future, so to speak, and spend a great deal of my available time, effort, and resources in simply making sure that my primary message in those 5 novels is heard and is available to anyone who wants to hear it. Now, this means even less chance than there was before Friday that I'm going to be able to mount my white horse, flourish my saber aloft, and like Teddy in Arsenic and Old Lace yell, "Charge!" Not going to be able to do that anytime soon. That charge will be led one day, but most likely not by me. Anyway, we'll talk about all this during the coming weeks. Right now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.